Welcome to another episode of the Carry Trainer Higher Line Podcast. Hey guys, welcome to another episode of the Higher Line Podcast, quickly approaching number 100. We've got our buddy here, the master of breath, I couldn't think of anything. I had like four things that were going to roll off the tongue. Before I just hit record, Brian, you've been in prison. You just got out of San Quentin.
I just got out of San Quentin this morning.
Yeah.
Literally. At 10:25, where I signed out, I walked out of San Quentin.
That's heavy.
Yeah. But at 7:55, I signed in and went in.
Okay, that's a good thing. That's a short sentence. So
that's a short time period.
Those of you that haven't been with us before or seen Brian's work, he is an expert in the field of how breath controls so much of our physiology, our metabolics in our body, the way it controls things like our attitude, and in a lot of ways, the outcome of our life. So he's been on the show before. We've done a YouTube video where he's presented to a group of our students. He's got a very prolific website and business teaching this stuff really around the world, right? You've gone other places teaching this stuff.
Yeah. Australia, Europe. We'll probably end up in South America at some point. I've done South America before. We've been on almost every continent other than I think we did do one seminar years ago, and not with this, but we did one in South Africa once.
Oh, cool. Cool. And you recently, since the last time I saw you, Cleveland Clinic, I think you were at,
working with the Cleveland Clinic,
their surgeons.
Yeah, I went into I got to go in and observe open heart surgery for the purposes of understanding how to bring high performance and high performance tools into that arena, as it's a high performance arena. That was interesting. But I also presented to 100 ER docs and nurses who are running the show in the ER, in a lot of the ERs for the Cleveland Clinic. On the physiology of breath and how it works and how we can actually help these folks regulate themselves in a much more, healthier way, because it's a very difficult, you know, being in a hospital is not, it's a carcinogen, you know, because you're inside.
I was going to talk to you about this. I've worked in an ER for a couple months this past winter clinicals.
You told me that.
Talk to you a little bit. And we all see this, like, you know, we visit a place like where it's high pace like that, but most of us, if you're not in that field, you're not like there when the customer service walls up, you know, you're not listening to people, how they talk and seeing what they're ingesting and going out for cigs. And you people are here every day when people are on their worst, dying and having, you know, various ailments. And then you're living off energy drinks and junk food and, you know, just general unhealthy badness.
Yeah. And all of that. So all that stuff that you're telling me that people use and do is literally a means of people using an outside in tool. So they're using something like a cigarette or an energy drink or coffee or whatever. And I'm not saying you can't use these things. And like, look, I drink coffee, but whatever. Is we're using these things in order to regulate ourselves, in order to feel better because we don't feel so hot, or we want to feel better because we feel like we could feel better, or we're just tired, or, you know, whatever. And this is about feeling as well, right? And so more or less what I'm teaching and what I'm trying to get people to do is I'm giving people the mode that I've figured out, that I've learned, you know, and there's much to learn beyond this. Like, there's a lot that we're learning, but breath is that instant thing, and it is that regulator of our autonomic nervous system. Like, we only have two ways of optimizing or taking back control of our autonomic nervous system. That's through breath or vision. So whether I'm putting myself in a proper visual field, and we went over this at the course we did together, you know, and how we can actually downshift ourselves or make a better decision by not being so high focused on one thing. And then it's through breath control, we can actually regulate this as well. And this all leads back to one thing, and that is getting back in touch with your physiology. Your physiology is your nature. That's nature. You are nature. Mm-hmm. I am nature. Mm-hmm. And we are so disconnected to the physiology of ourselves that we seek outside in stimulation because there's such a heightened thing with it. And then we don't understand that being in front of a screen all day or being under false light all day, what that's actually doing to us. Yeah.
I'm surrounded by light.
Right? Well, no, it's not a problem. Like, look, if you were outside, you'd actually be getting more light. Like, you'd be getting more light, like, just so we're clear. But if it's, you know, 9, 10, 11, 12 o'clock, 1 a.m., and you've got all these lights on you, you're really messing some things up. And this goes well beyond circadian rhythm. It starts to dig into, well, my breathing rate's off because now I'm very reactionary to things at this point. And so I've messed with it. And this is what we're really working on is CO2 tolerance, which is the reason mm-hmm. we breathe. And this is our direct connection into our regulation of our system, because carbon dioxide is the metabolic stress messenger of the body, whether it's thinking or whether it's physical work. Carbon dioxide, CO2 tolerance changes. And so I become, when this changes, I react to it because that's my breathing centers are set up in my brainstem. So it's part of, boom, this is where reaction comes. So if I have an emotional response to something or I'm in a situation where I'm thinking and I'm trying to solve a problem, my breathing starts to change as a result of that because that's downstream from the thinking and it's all the output, right? Like, so I think I need to walk. So I start walking, right? That went from thinking down the brainstem and is orchestrated out through the spinal cord, right? So motor control, all these things start to happen. Well, my sympathetic, parasympathetic, my autonomic nervous system is largely set up in that brainstem. And my breathing is part of that process where it regulates as a result of that. So the dog can either wag the tail, I control my breathing, or I become aware of my breathing. Or the tail can wag the dog. I'm not in control of it. I don't even know what's going on with it. And it's out of control, right?
How did those doctors at the Cleveland Clinic, you had 100 of them. I bet you most of them dug it. But was there a few of them that are like, this guy's not a doctor. We know how breathing works.
I didn't feel that way, although I was prepared for that. I didn't get that sense from anybody. And in fact, the one guy who I kept looking at, who you know the one person that you're always seeing in the crowd when you're presenting or talking, like this fucker is he's picking me apart.
You can't
think about it too much because it'll throw your whole speech and your whole thing off, right? But that dude was one of the three docs that ended up coming up to me at the end saying, "Man, I really wish we learned physiology the way you just explained it."
So you maybe misinterpreted hyper-attentiveness to him maybe being condescending or something, like his facial
Correct.
Expression. Yeah, that
Correct.
Happens. I've done that.
And as much reading as I do on patterns and, you know, recognition, you know, I mean, I've read books like the Ellipsis Manual and studied it and been like, you know, when somebody starts itching, you know, what's going on, histamine response. And so they're probably lying or they're in a heightened situation. You know, they cross their legs a certain way. Like, I think I'm all good at this stuff. Right. And then it's like, you know, you start to think you understand people. And you know, lo and behold, man, that happens more times than not where it's the person.
Well, some people have just learned like a funny facial expression that doesn't totally fit with what's inside of them too. I have a loved one that everybody always thinks they're angry and they're not. Mm-hmm. They're just like, you know, like, oh, yeah, she ain't angry. That's just her face. You know? Like, yeah. Like, she just always, you know, looks kind of grumpy. Yeah.
So, it's funny. You know, what I'm doing is really getting people to understand their breathing, because their breathing is an instant reaction to what is going on. And any awareness or control of that is a means back to feeling what's going on inside the nature of the system, my physiology, because my physiology is responding to what's going on internally, right? And so this is an inside out means of regulating things. So if I want to feel up,
I'm sorry, I just want to say it's like one of the things I've taken away from reading your stuff and listening to you is it's flipping cause and effect on its head.
Yes.
Is really what I've taken away from it. Like, we think I'm breathing this way because this is happening, when in reality, this is happening because you're breathing this way.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I had an inmate this morning. He's like, he's 70. And,
Hold on a second. So you've been teaching this shit all over the world, writing about it. You physically test it with your own body, running crazy ultra races and like plunging into ice baths and all that stuff. And you and your buddies all test it. But now, and you've taught it to all kinds of people, from military to law enforcement to doctors. So now you're fast forward, you're at San Quentin, dangerous prison. Okay, just so we're all caught up.
Yeah,
How'd that get set up?
I live 5 miles from San Quentin, and okay. I'm connected to an agency that represents a number of people, and one of the people they represent is a guy who started a program called the Anti-Recidivism Coalition, because we have a very big problem within our correctional facilities with men and women coming right back after they've done time.
That's huge.
And so, you know, I could have very well ended up in prison. You know, I mean, I went to jail as a kid, you know, a number of times for stupid shit. You know, and I could have made some pretty poor decisions and could have wound. I'll never deny the fact that I, you know, couldn't have wound up in a place like that very easily.
Me and you talked about that on our first podcast together. I'm the same way.
Yeah. And I think a lot of
unbridled energy.
Yes. Yeah. And I didn't find what my true, you know, north or whatever was. And, you know, regardless if I've found it or not, I've found something I'm really passionate about and giving back. And so I found a way in to get into San Quentin and offer up my time every time, if I'm in town and, you know, so every Friday I head in for 2 hours to teach the art of breath and what we do. And
so you're
same
like a
thing
chaplain, like, a chaplain of sorts.
Yeah. And more or less what I'm doing is I'm showing these guys exactly how breath control works with the brain, with your physiology, and with how you move and how you can actually manipulate that. And one of the big things that I relayed to these guys in the beginning, and I reinforce almost, you know, every other week or so, is, you know, there's a group of people who will literally give up all possessions and head to the mountains in Asia somewhere, and they will meditate the rest of their lives and seek enlightenment. And they eat one or two meals a day, and they live in total seclusion and isolation. And this is a means of what they do in order to find enlightenment, that who they are and how they feel. And although they may not have a choice being where they're at, they do have some time to do some things. And it's a choice in how you want to do that time. And if I see it as more or less an opportunity for them to understand this on a grand scale, and there's no reason why they couldn't become some Zen master inside. And we've seen this in many documentaries and things like this, where men and women fix them, you know, to end up fixing their issues and come to terms with it and stop doing things. And, you know, I mean, one of the guys, his name's Roach. he's probably my star student. And, you know, he's brought up in a lot of foster care, like had a really horrific upbringing, all this stuff, like stuff I've never experienced, but man, it's, you can see why it was tough. And here he is in a prison, and, he's coming to this thing, and he, you know, we've talked, obviously I've been there for a few months. So I've been teaching this stuff on and off, and we've gotten to some real deep stuff and through the coursework. And he, the other day, came in, this is last week, and he just walked up to me. He goes, "You're telling the truth." And I was like, "What am I telling the truth about?"
Yeah.
I hadn't said anything. And he goes, "Well, you said this breath stuff would change us. And, you know, the other day a dude started a fight with me and I couldn't hit him. And I'm not somebody who does not hit back. He goes, I just couldn't hit him. I said, well, why couldn't you hit him? He said, because I was aware of my breathing. I didn't have time to, I knew that if I hit him, I wouldn't have been doing the thing that I was working on. And I needed to work on my breathing because here was a guy that really, he was kind of like, I could have kicked his ass. He's like 300 pounds. He's like super overweight, like all this stuff. Like what would have been the point of me kicking his ass? And so I didn't fight him and I walked away and I smiled as I walked away. And that was the first time I've ever done that in my adult life.
Cause and effect.
And I was like, there you go, man. You just figured out the whole thing. Welcome to the path. Like, this is your path. And how deep do you want to go? And so each week we kind of set up homework and stuff for them to do to kind of increase that CO2 tolerance, their ability, you know, because we use CO2 tolerance because the shorter that, the less of the CO2 tolerance we have, the faster we're really breathing sometimes. And that also means that I don't have, because it's the metabolic stress messenger of the body, I have a shorter period of time until I react.
Let's dig into that. Let's dig into that for a minute. So CO2 tolerance 101.
Yeah. So we are an aerobic functioning species. We have evolved through aerobic metabolism. And even though anaerobic metabolism exists and we use it all the time, it is our default stress response to things. This is the difference basically, and these are two different things, but it's like being in a heightened sympathetic state and a calm parasympathetic state. Fight, flight, freeze versus rest, digest, recover, reproduce, creativity, right? Processing, that happens in parasympathetic, okay? So my CO2 tolerance, I have dedicated chemoreceptors in the aortic and the carotid artery in my vasculature. This is going outwards towards the periphery. So arteries are out, right? Veins are back in. It's a predictive system of carbon dioxide going to be high or low. And my breath centers are set up in my brain specifically to detect those carbon dioxide levels. That's what a chemoreceptor does, is it detects the carbon dioxide levels. And so the brain stem picks up on that. When I'm unconscious of my breathing, I breathe based on a specific pattern or specific tolerance I've had to the CO2. Think of it like this. Holding your breath as long as you can. Then me having you go and get in the water, and I'll say, all right, we're going to hold your breath, but I'm going to put my arm on you. I'm going to put my hand on your arm and hold you under. But when you need to come up, you can come up. Which one are you going to hold your breath longer at? Well, the one I'm not involved in and you're not underwater, right? And maybe if we took a free diver, that'd be different. But the fact of the matter is that's somebody who's highly trained at this versus the rest of us. Our response to breathe is not because oxygen levels are low. Our response to breathe is because CO2 rises. And so when we think we're out of breath, it's just we've accumulated more CO2 than we're ready to deal with. And so in the brain, set up is a panic switch at the heart of how we function. That panic switch is there. It's called the suffocation alarm system. If I have too high a CO2 levels or too low of oxygen levels, it starts to go off. Ring, ding, 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 ding. And I start to freak out. That's that claustrophobic feeling that people get, right? And this is, we're seeing that this is directly tied to our ability to tolerate CO2. In fact, we've got some research that's being done. We've got a thesis that's been done on it where state anxiety is directly correlated to CO2 tolerance. And a low CO2 tolerance is predictable to higher anxiety levels. That means I'm more reactive to things. The bigger we build that CO2 tolerance, the less reactive we become to things, and we start to be able to process things. This makes sense from a physiological perspective, from an aerobic functioning perspective, because when I'm more parasympathetic, I'm leaning towards more high aerobic function. When I'm more sympathetic, I'm leaning more towards stress, anaerobic, fight, flight, freeze, default set patterning all this stuff. And this can go really into the weeds of like, you know, how I learned to function emotionally as a kid and survival skills and how I got love and attention, you know, that inevitably plays out as I become an adult. And so when I default into these things, when I'm too stressed, whether it's I've got too much going on from work, life, and everything, or I'm in a very, you know, like think about it. If I had a really stressful day at work and then all of a sudden somebody shows up, I'm in the store getting something and some dude comes in to rob the store. What do you think how you're going to react is going to be based on if you're overloaded versus if you're not overloaded? Mm-hmm. Your mm-hmm. processing is very different in those situations. And this is why we teach breath control, because it then becomes something where if I'm going in to talk to doctors, they're making better decisions when they're in medicine. Or if I'm talking to an inmate, that they're actually starting to see how they actually operate and function and what they're reacting to and what's real and what really isn't, and how they can actually change that narrative by using their breath to become more aware of it and responding differently. But I give them the opportunity to dig into that. I'm not the therapist. I'm just the guy who's literally saying, here's how we control it. Here's where the choice is at. Here's how we build this. Here's where you get the opportunity to make a much different decision.
And so some of these inmates now are applying it and seeing a positive result. That's good stuff.
Yep. Big time. I mean, I've got guys.
Go ahead. I was going to say, you're documenting some of this, I'm assuming.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
You're about to say you've got.
Oh, I mean, I've got a guy in there who's got heart stuff, and he's got cancer, and his numbers, he keeps going back to the doc every month, and his doc's like, what are you doing? And he's like, I'm doing this breath stuff. She's like, who is teaching you this? What is going on here? He's like, here's the guy. Here's what he's doing. Here's what we're learning. And he's getting back control of his physiology. I'm not suggesting he's going to cure anything or change anything, but his numbers and his physiology are changing. He feels better. If I've got a guy who goes up, you know, a 70-year-old man who's now waking up in the middle of the night because his mouth opens because he used to have sleep apnea and he was snoring his brains out and sleeping poorly because his mouth opens. Now he wakes up when his mouth opens and he shuts his mouth and he goes back to sleep and breathes through his nose.
Awesome.
Like, awesome. It's just comes full circle. And whether we're talking and dealing with professional athletes, the same is there. And it's like we can regulate metabolic function through breath control. So using breath control to actually regulate specific things that we want to get out of the energy we're trying to use while training.
I think a lot of people don't understand. You're talking about anaerobic versus aerobic metabolism in the process, or with oxygen involved in the process, anaerobic without oxygen. And I think sometimes we don't understand that, like, that is without it, we don't get energy, we don't live. So it's just like a fire, and without this oxygen carbon dioxide balance, with it being askew, that whole combustion process is askew, or can be, right?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And I mean, look, man, our five senses are the interpretation of an environment that we're in. And so when you have things like where you've had a stressful day and you come home and you're like, I've got this craving for sugar or whatever, like that's a real good sign that you've been pretty hot, because you're burning through a lot more glycogen, a lot more sugar. And so your body's going, yo, I need more
of
that.
That's pretty cool. So it's not just that somebody maybe has a sweet tooth.
Oh, no, no, no. I used to have a pretty good sweet tooth before I got into all this stuff. And it's not even close to what it is. Like, I could give or take sweets anytime. Like, I'm just like, I used to pound donuts, you know, once every couple of weeks or something, you know, just like as a little treat. I just don't even have the interest to, like,
After you began to experience this stuff, you'd still treat yourself to a little donut.
You got it. Yeah. And it's not that I don't from time to time, but the fact of the matter is here's what's happened is I've learned to regulate my physiology. So when I have these heightened stress situations, like You know, I mean, I'm talking with you for, you know, we're going to be talking for at least an hour, right? I'm going to be talking a lot. I'm going to be setting myself off more. I'm not going to be using the oxygen as efficiently as I can because I'm dumping more CO2. Mm-hmm. That's what inevitably happens with mouth breathing. That's why the guy wakes up. I wake up in the middle of the night if I'm mouth breathing because it sets me off. I get in a heightened state. Oh, yeah, it wakes me up. It's a natural thing. Think about working out. If I start working out harder, I default into breathing through my mouth because I need to offload that metabolic waste. The harder I work, the more metabolic waste occurs, right? And so that waste, 70% of all waste is dumped is through my breathing. So my exhale. And that's how I get rid of it. So if I don't have a lot of waste, but I'm going to set myself off sympathetically,
sure,
and inevitably wake myself up and be like, oh.
So
takes a little training. But yeah.
Is there a diminishing return to CO2 tolerance? Can you develop past the point where it's not good for you anymore? Do we not know?
I would largely say we don't know what that number is. Although, look, now there are people who do deal with pathology in this department, and you'll see a lot of the elderly population there where they just have way too much CO2 buildup. That being said, that fits more into the problem side of things. Like some of the greatest free divers in the world are still working on their CO2 tolerance so that they can hold their breath longer and longer. It's not like they're training their physiology to keep more CO2 in the system to release more of the oxygen, because that's how oxygen gets released, is the carbon dioxide molecules prefer to attach to the red blood cells. And when that happens, it replaces the oxygen. So the oxygen kicks off and it gets to be used with the mitochondria.
It's cool.
Yeah.
That's super cool. That balance that allows us to live, man. It's heavy.
Yeah. And most of us are so much like we're a little too CO2 intolerant. And thus we're not utilizing the oxygen as efficiently as we can. You know,
what would be something that was symptomatic of intolerant to CO2 that the person's listening could say, oh man, that's me. I feel that, or I experience that. How would they know?
Shortness of breath.
You not just know that means you're just out of shape and fat, or is it one and the same?
That is one and the same, my man.
Okay.
Yeah. That it just so happens that is one in the same, but it also is interesting because even at the highest level of sport, and we've seen this with world champions, Olympic gold medalists, you can still be CO2 intolerant and suffer your way through metabolically really high workloads and really stressful shit. We're an amazing machine.
Yeah.
And we adapt, but it doesn't mean we can't optimize or self-optimize. And it's just like putting on glasses because my vision's getting a little tweaky. It's like I'm just using some glasses right now in order to help my vision out, right? And so, like, look, there's a lot of ailments that can, you know, it's interesting, but we tend to see that when people start to increase that CO2 tolerance, a lot of the stressors or things around stress, including autonomic, you know, like autoimmune stuff, digestive things. I've gotten a lot of feedback. Asthma. I'm not running around claiming cure all because I'm not, but these things tend to start to right themselves.
Just because the system becomes righted.
Yes. Yeah.
It's kind of like, when I first heard you start talking about this, you know, I grew up a little farm kid and, you know, we had a lawn tractors and dirt bikes and weed whippers and chainsaws. And I'm not a very good mechanic, but, you know, we'd have like a carburetor in the chainsaw go bad sitting all winter long and get gummed up. So you'd have to tear the little carb apart and scrub it out. And, I found sometimes I could get things to run by fucking around with the choke maybe, or, maybe cleaning the air filter out. It didn't run great, but if I kept full throttle, you know, when it started to die, I could maybe, you know, feather the throttle and keep the machine running where I could keep doing the work. But, like, it never was right. But then if I sat down, tore the carburetor apart, got all the jets clean, and, you know, talked to my buddy who was a real mechanic and figured out how to set all of the parameters of the fuel and oxygen mixture correctly, all of a sudden the thing worked great again. Like, that's what I keep thinking about as you're talking.
What happens if you put a blower on a car?
Yeah, man, she goes. She goes.
You're just giving her more oxygen.
Yeah, yeah.
That's it, man. That's it. And, like, that's all we're talking about, is getting people the oxygen in order so that they can go more. And it might take a little time, but once they start to get this, it starts to play a role. And it's like even just 5-10 minutes of breath work in the morning or evening can start to have a compounding effect to where I start to become aware of that throughout my day. Like, what can I do in between stressful situations? And it's just slowing down my breathing a little bit. And the more you get, the more you're doing with this stuff, the better you train this, the faster it happens.
There's some psychological stuff attached to that too. Like, I've talked about this with you before, but growing up with chronic anxiety. It's a podcast I did earlier with another friend. He talked about having panic attacks and one day telling himself while he was on a treadmill, he was going to leave the gym. He started to have the symptoms of the panic attack. And his normal thing would be, I'm going to go home, curl up in a ball, and like wait till this goes away. And this day he was so sick of it, he said to himself, you're going to stay running on this treadmill. He had set a distance to run until you're finished or until your ass passes out and somebody finds you on the floor. And he said about 30 seconds later, he was okay. Like, he kind of like drew a line in the sand with himself and started to meter his breath. And, you know, some of it was the physiological part, but the psychological part, like, they dovetailed into each other.
We like to talk about, and this is in part what's happened with education and the medical system, is we like to compartmentalize a lot of things like psychology and physiology and, you know, mechanics and movement and muscles and all of these things, like, you know, the digestive system. And these things, you know, are the only place they're separate is in conversation.
Yeah.
They are connected. They are interconnected. We're under the impression right now, and my good friend Fergus Connolly said this, and he said, is psychology just misunderstood physiology?
All that means is
I just don't understand what's going on with my physiology, and I don't know where I went wrong, and I've set myself off. So if I've had a big day, I've taken on too many tasks, I've, you know, been in front of the screen and done too many emails, and then I had some project pop up, or, you know, something happened in traffic, somebody cut me off, and, you know, this happened, and then I sat in traffic, and then I came home and my wife was, you know, gone, or, you know, something happened with her, or, you know, like, things just start compiling, right? Well, if you didn't regulate yourself through any of that, you've just taken on a whole lot of stuff that you've not allowed yourself to process. And that doesn't mean we need to go sit in lotus or cross-legged and start meditating. Like, meditation's great and it's a great tool, right? But it's also like we can regulate ourselves by controlling breathing, by actually taking the opportunity to take control of our breathing and bring ourselves down off that mountain, like sitting in traffic. I lived in Southern California for 40 years, and the traffic there is horrific.
Yeah, it is.
I would constantly be sitting in traffic being like, fuck, damn it. Like, this sucks. Like, I need to be somewhere. I need to be there. Well, I'm not getting there any quicker, right? Airports, planes, delays, things going wrong, like, all this stuff starts to compile. And it's like, I start to lose myself with that. Breathing turned me into the guy that was smiling in traffic versus being upset in traffic. Because I'm like, what can I do about this? Absolutely nothing. I can actually change my attitude about it, and right. I can't be anywhere. So could I do some work? Like, could I make some phone calls? Or if I can't, how about some personal shit? Put on, some music and do some breathing, or listen to a podcast or whatever, get some information or an audio book, and take this time as an opportunity to do something that's going to help me in that moment. And so I ended up becoming a very different person in traffic. If there's nothing I can do about it, even if I'm late, what's the purpose of being upset?
Yeah. You're just burning a bunch of energy for nothing.
It's just a wasted energy. And that's basically the crux of what we're teaching, is this is all about energy. And the only means we have of regulating energy or moving energy is through our breath. That's how we do it. The stuff we put in our mouth.
So somebody would say, well, wait a minute. Digestion consumes energy. Thoughts consume energy. Movement consumes energy. But you're saying the gas pedal to that is breath.
You got it.
Okay. Just want to make sure
That's the regulator of energy. 500 million years ago, this planet figured out how multicellular organisms decided to communicate and use the oxygen that an algae ended up creating through photosynthesis. And that was the biggest explosion of life. And everything that we know of, this is the most efficient way we move energy, is through aerobic metabolism. And so even things like the combustible engine were manufactured in that same fashion. We need oxygen to make this thing run. So how do we do that? What do we do with it? Take a hot fuel. If there's no oxygen, guess what? Fuel don't burn.
Right.
Right? Everything's been modeled after it. And it's not the anaerobics. Anaerobic's there because anaerobic was there before aerobic was. It became the secondary system. It's the default system. It's a beautiful system. And it's working at all times as well when there's not enough oxygen where cells need it. So if there's not an oxygen
molecule, you can't do that indefinitely, though, is the problem.
No, it's very short-term limited. It's your savings account. It's your savings account. And that's why you need to use your aerobic system so that you can – your aerobic system is manageable waste. Your anaerobic system is not manageable waste. You can't keep up with it. So the oxygen that ends up – you're pulling in ends up going to buffering the byproduct of that anaerobic stuff, the hydrogen ions, the high levels of carbon dioxide that come off of it. That's where you become acidic.
And so the oxygen, that's where you start to get the lactic acid and your muscles are fucking smoked. And
yeah, you've got too much lactate, you've got too much CO2 in the system. So you need more oxygen so that you can help convert that back into energy again.
So you got to slow down and breathe.
You got it. And so if you're in control of your breathing, you know exactly where you're at all times. So there isn't a thing I don't do at this point where I don't, training-wise, whether it's jiu-jitsu, whether it's on the bike, whether it's in the gym, where I'm not aware and controlling my breathing and knowing where I want to be and how I want to be. The moment I lose control of my breath, I kill. Because I know if I've lost control of my breath, I'm shutting down. Like, I'm literally defaulting into hardwired poor programming.
So where does somebody want to go? Like, all right, so besides like, okay, I'm out of breath. That was the one symptom you said, being out of breath. Is there any other like blatant ones to having poor tolerance for CO2?
I mean, there's a ton of stuff. I mean, you can like, so I'm more anxious. Your type A's are typically people who are pretty like, go, 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 go. Can't shut off. You're probably pretty CO2 intolerant unless you've been working at it.
Does things like smoking cigarettes?
That actually increases CO2 tolerance in a odd way.
So like, I used to be a smoker for 20 years. I had a better CO2 tolerance as a smoker.
Probably because slower controlled breathing patterns. Yeah.
Interesting. Maybe I'm going to take
There's a diminishing return on that, though.
Yeah. That's true. That's interesting. So the person listening that says, okay, man, I have no knowledge of my breath, and we've talked about this every time I've chatted with you. You've got a whole system or systems on that achieve various goals, but just to, like, an immediate stopgap, you just showed us deep inhalation through the nose, deep inhalation or exhalation through the nose. Like, then what? Just do it again? Do you pause? Do you, You know, are you thinking a certain thing? Are you imagining a warm light all around you? Are you floating on an endless sea of love?
The question is what do you want? If you want to understand it more, I would start playing with different breathing protocols, different methods, understanding the gas pedal, how it works. There's times and places for when you need to mouth breathe, like when I'm talking or when I'm working out really hard. But do I have control of that? When I want to recover from something, like let's say I went after a perp, right? Like I'm a cop, went after a perp, boom, I'm on it. Get the guy, take everything. Well, take him down, get him handcuffed. Well, I need to get my head about me really quick. What's the fastest way to do that? Blow off that waste product till I feel like I can get control of controlled breathing, controlled breathing with my nose.
So you went from mouth breathing on the sprint to flipping the switch to the nose breathing and controlling and slowing the respiration rates.
Yep.
Okay. But you first offloaded with the mouth.
Yeah. Breathing? When you're in heightened stressful situations and you feel it, you feel the stress coming on like shit, this is going to be a problem. Start using that mouth breathing to offload the CO2 so that you can actually start to use more of the O2 and get back and normalize.
Is there a point where, like, how fast, how deep, how long? I know it's just hyper specific.
Context.
Context.
How much do you need? The idea is you wanted to get in as much air as you can, and then let that off. You want to go till you start to feel yourself almost normalize, like you feel like, oh, okay, I'm feeling better now. Then it's, I default back to, but if I can control it with my nose in a heightened stressful situation, you are going to be way more aware of everything that's going on.
Talk about that. Why? What does that have to do with the price of rice in China?
You're more parasympathetic dominant. Nasal breathing, you've got more connection to your vagus nerve and the parasympathetic branch of that. And so you're actually keeping yourself in a very peripheral, open processing state. This is where your creativity, rest, digest, recover. This allows us to actually process what's going on.
You're telling me that sucking air through these two holes versus this one hole is going to change all of what you just said. Can.
You got it. Yes. Correct.
Does every doctor support that? This isn't me being contrary. I know, like, one time we did a video and we had that total douche that went on.
I've had pulmonologists that have come on literally like I've talked to these guys and they're like, this is solid. Like, look, the nose was designed with the respiratory system in mind. Yeah, and I know that guy said what he said, but he went off into a dark place.
This is not me trying to validate what he was saying. I'm just – what my goal is that you have people that are learned that feel a certain way. So what I'm trying to do is give the listener some ammunition so that when they're doing research on their own or talking about this with their primary health care doctor or starting to dig into your work, they understand – yeah, there might be some people that have a different viewpoint, but I'm looking outside. All of a sudden, it got really black out. It's only 3 o'clock here. Yeah.
So the nose is designed with the respiratory system in mind. You've got hairs for filtering. You've got mucus for catching a lot of those particles and debris that comes in. There's T cells inside the mucus that start to set up your immune system, immune function, first line of defense for your immune function. Your sinuses humidify and warm the air. And then you actually are using or engaging that diaphragm because it's a resistance breathing device to a large degree. I need to actually use that big muscle that's responsible for creating the reverse vacuum. And this makes sense from a mechanical standpoint because the diaphragm it circumnavigates the rib cage and is up against the spine as well. So any deviation in that spine becomes a problem for me or makes it more difficult for me to actually access that diaphragm. But if I'm actually using my nose to breathe, I'm actually setting myself up mechanically even better. So everything's really working to get the oxygen into the system so that I can use and move energy. My mouth is just a means of getting more oxygen in and more carbon dioxide out. From what we've seen, we're not only at intense levels, so levels in more intense, like if we're working out at higher intensity levels, do we only absorb more of the oxygen when we mouth breathe because it's so much faster to get it in. But at non-intense levels, the nose is absorbing just as much, you're absorbing just as much oxygen in as you are with your mouth.
Hmm.
Okay. Yeah. And so it's the exhale that starts to become what we're seeing. And that exhale offloads less carbon dioxide. It takes longer to get the CO2 out through this versus how fast it dumps here. And so when I offload too much CO2, or I don't necessarily need to offload that much CO2, I inevitably don't use as much of the oxygen. This is what's called the Bohr effect.
Say that last part again. It's called what?
The Bohr effect, B-O-H-R-E-F-F-E-C-T.
Effect. Okay.
This states you need enough carbon dioxide in the blood in order to utilize the oxygen coming out. Now, at some time and place, if you're working hard enough, that will be necessary. There, look, this isn't my ideas. This isn't my thinking. This is just the road and what we've learned. A lot of this stuff is thousands of years old. Some of it's even newer. There's a book out there called Jaws, The Hidden Epidemic. That is about how our jaws have literally started to recede. We're one of the only species that has crooked teeth. And this is largely in part because of what's happened to our breathing patterns over time. And we've just started to, yeah. Yep. And so it's a lot more difficult for modern man for us to breathe through our nose because of the lifestyle and the choices and the nutrition and everything that we've been doing.
Are you using like SpO2 monitors and Entitle CO2 so like in your studies and training to, I don't know how, you know, you probably can't run down the road with some of this equipment.
I do personally, yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I have an SpO2 monitor on. I would say probably most days out of the week.
Just looking at walking around?
No, as I'm doing breath practice stuff, specific stuff.
Okay. So you've got training. Goals and you can then that you can then correlate immediately, because it is pretty instantaneous what you're doing to what the output is on the monitor.
Yeah, yeah. There's actually a little bit of a delay. It's roughly like 30 seconds.
By instantaneous, so, yeah. I'm saying you're not like you need to go, you know, download shit to a printer. It's you're seeing it in pretty much real time, though.
Yeah, yeah. The big thing I want to get my hands on is some stuff that actually starts to monitor CO2. So, or when we become hypocapnic, which is mm-hmm. when you start to go, because you've just got so much carbon dioxide, you're cooked. And that inevitably is that point where everybody kind of, whether we're talking emotionally, psychologically, or physically.
Okay. My recent EMS program I was working on, there's a big push now for Entitle CO2 monitoring because people are figuring out it tells you a lot about the patient. It tells you a lot about what's happening with the patient. It's information that people were previously not so concerned with at that level of medical care.
Yeah. We're going to see in the coming years that CO2, this is going to become more and more, I'm not the only one who's onto this. We're working with folks and, that have been researching, high, really bad cases of anxiety, like medically treated people with anxiety and administering carbon dioxide, bolus hits of carbon dioxide and in one breath, and then having them regulate themselves, and it kind of tricks the brain into going, oh, this wasn't as bad as I thought, and they're instantaneously finding relief and anxiousness and anxiety as a result of that. Couple that with breath training and you start to get these symptoms start to kind of regulate themselves versus being in a dysregulated state.
It's strange how much is known about this stuff, how it's such an important integral component to life, and how much, I don't want to sound, I don't want this to be taken wrong, but how much so many people in this field are looked at like as like, you know, witch doctors, not you per se, but like, oh yeah, that's just like some Eastern medicine bullshit. Like, no man, like literally, like if you shut these three holes, you're dead. Like, you know, 60 seconds or so, you go to sleep and don't wake back up. And of course, we understand you got to breathe. It's like the basis of CPR and all that good shit. But like a lot of the stuff you're talking about, we had that doctor come onto that post and share his your point was this guy's just trying to sound like he knows what he's talking about, which I didn't disagree with. It's interesting, though, sometimes to engage assholes. So for you guys listening, we did a video with Brian, and a gentleman came on there and pontificated for paragraph after paragraph about all he knew about the human species. And I use those situations sometimes to let people that read the comments know, like, one, this is somebody's viewpoint, but like, here's like some, you know, side points, or here's a way to like look at it. And here's maybe this guy's like, I see where he's coming from, but, and Brian's like, yeah, fuck that guy.
Well, like anytime you've got to like jump on something to disprove what somebody is saying, like he didn't disprove anything. He literally just went into a diatribe about like how things really operate and this and that. And it was literally, you could just read how threatened he was by something. And I'm not discounting most of what he said wasn't true, but he was literally I think he was pissed off about the fact, like he felt like mouth breathing was perfectly fine to do. And I'm like, I think you need to look into this a little further, because that's not what we're seeing. And I'm literally, I didn't just go, you know what? I think I'm going to start talking about nasal only breathing, or breathing more through our noses, because that's what I want to do. We went out and applied this, and now we're actually, we have researchers studying it. And we have medical people looking at it too.
Anybody that ever watches a boxing match and you listen to the referee say, oh, you know, Brian's breathing through his mouth, folks, it's going to be over soon. Like that's, we recognize it, or you see a runner. Like that guy's smoked. Yes. He's at the end.
Yeah. I mean, McGregor's going to fight this weekend again. Remember when he fought Floyd Mayweather? Floyd waited until that kid's jaw was open. And then I think it was round 9. And he's like, okay, time to end this. I'm going to make soup of this kid right now. And that's exactly what happened.
Got gassed. Fatigue makes cowards of all men.
It does. And, you know, anxiety can do numbers on us as well.
Yeah. Takes your mind out of the game.
Yeah, man. It's tough. You, I get it.
You, what was that big race that you told me about that you ran, the one in the desert? Big elevation changes that you did? The one you said, like, I asked about one race, and you're like, nothing compared to this race. You said it was blazing, lots of elevation change and high heat.
Well, I mean, I did Western States, which is high heat. That was a lot of elevation change, but I did Angeles Crest 100, which was in LA, through the Mount Angeles National Forest. That was pretty high heat. But I've run, so I paced Dean Karnazes and a guy by the name of John Radich, a number of times through Badwater, which starts in Death Valley and ends at Whitney Portal. So at 8,500 feet.
When you say you paced him, what does that mean for us non-ultra?
I ran with him for a good chunk of the race. So with Dean, I think I did something like 60 or 70 miles with him. John, I've done upwards of like 90. I think it was like around 90 with John.
How long is that race in total?
They have 60 hours to complete that.
How far is it?
135 miles.
So why didn't you just run the whole thing? I mean, come on.
Well, you're not allowed to start the first 17 miles with them. They need to be able to do the first 17 by themselves.
Why?
They should have their shit together enough, I guess, to be able to do
that. I'm saying, like, did you ever plan to just enter it and run it, start to finish?
I did. I did. I was actually registered, and I was going to run it 1 year, but then I was going through a ton of crap, and I was like, I couldn't train. I was like, there's no way I can show up to this event. I couldn't wrap my head around competing or doing that event without training, having the time to dedicate for the training, and thus I did not.
But you've done these 100-mile races. I've been reading about these things and reading of like people that do these like 100-plus-mile races, and you didn't do it from what you've told me because you love racing. You wanted just to see what your physical limits were and test some of your theories out here.
Yeah, I mean, I just want I want to understand me. Like, I want to understand what I'm capable of, what I go through when I do these things. I mean, I would say doing ultra marathons for those that are processing them are very cathartic, almost psychedelic like experiences, to where you get to see yourself at the lowest of lows and the highest of highs and understand a lot of different things. And one of the things I picked up on was the fact that pain really is just a sense. And, you know, I was in more pain. I remember vividly just being in so much pain at Western States. And then literally within like a minute or so, I was moving faster and I was going downhill and I felt like I was floating and I was no longer in pain. And I was like, I just got my head out of it and the pain disappeared. Like, that's just insane to me. Like,
it's so when we tell ourselves like pain's your body telling you something's wrong, maybe that's not always the case.
Pain's there for a reason. It's nature's way of saying wrong to some degree, but it's also something that if we dedicate more space in our brain to, which a lot of people are in chronic pain. I know a lot of people who aren't in chronic pain, but are in pain. And the people who actually are more in this chronic pain, we've seen this, and Dr. Norman Deutsch did a book called The Brain's Way of Healing. And they looked at this and they've got other researchers that looked at this as well. And people who deal with chronic pain tend to dedicate up to 15 to 20% more neurons in an area to that pain than people who don't deal with chronic pain. It's more like 5% of the neurons go to pain, right? So like that means if I were to take a needle and poke you in the hand with it,
don't do it.
You would probably be somebody who would be like, fuck, that hurt, dude. But you'd be over it pretty quickly. Where somebody else who's like, oh my God, why would you do that? Oh, that hurts me so bad. Like I'm carrying on about the pain, right? And I'm hurt and this and that. Those of us that carry pain and use pain is this vehicle for, I don't want to say necessarily victimizing ourselves, but I've fallen into this category from emotional to physical, whatever. Like I've had stuff wrong with me that like, oh, I couldn't stop thinking about. But then it was like, well, what are you doing about it? You know? What are you doing about the pain? Are you changing the way you move? Are you doing any mobility or flexibility stuff? Are you going to a therapist? Like, what are you doing about that stuff? Mm-hmm. And it's when I start doing or investing in that, that's when the things start to change. But it just so happens too that my breathing responds to pain as well. And how the acidity or the pH of my blood, of my body, the higher that acidity is, the more susceptible I am to pain, like the more pain I feel.
Yeah.
The more pain receptor sites go off.
I just had a podcast a couple of weeks ago with Devin Larratt, Canadian Special Operations, like their highest level of special operations. And then he's now considered one of the greatest arm wrestlers of all time. He's like 6'5", 270 pounds, which I always thought he was small because you see the arm wrestling videos and stuff that he's in. And most of these guys are like 300 plus pounders, like in this open weight class. And he's built, I mean, he's not, he's freaking a beast, but
he's a special forces guy, and he's 270.
Yeah, that's the cool thing. So, you know, we start talking a little bit. I think he was like a little lighter, like 250 at the time. So kind of you're not your typical dude. But he's into a lot of this long distance stuff, or has been. And this, he had a lot of really cool discussions about like what goes on in these muscles just from the abuse of this, you know, trashing of these muscles, doing this crazy arm wrestling. And how he gets blood in there, because he knows that he's got to get oxygen in there to pull all the junk out that he's building up with the, not just the lactic acid and such, but the damage, trashing these joints, doing this crazy arm wrestling shit. And it's like, he thinks that that's one of the things that's allowed him to be, have the longevity and be so good at it, is his ability. I don't know if it's exercises he's doing, how he's swinging his arms around or what, but getting the gas exchange. That's one of the things he said, is getting the gas exchange to happen where he needs it to help flush the toxins out and bring the nutrients into the tissues to heal them. Massage, you know, all kinds of shit to help.
Yeah. Well, I mean, your tissue responds to the energy you're using, right? Mm-hmm. And so the more sympathetic I lean, the more stiff and, you know, I mean, you're asking like, how do I know I'm CO2 intolerant? Well, flexibility, tissue, like if your tissue is constantly in pain, if you're doing stuff to it, like you're rolling out on a foam roller and you're in pain, all that, like that's highly sympathetic tissue, which means you're probably a little CO2 intolerant as well, because you can't get a lot of blood flow through that stuff.
So I got a buddy that's always, he said he's always dehydrated, even though he's always chugging water. He's always got freaking crazy joint pain. He comes to the house and I got this countertop that's got this funky corner up high. He's jamming shoulders and pecs into it. He's always got knots and stuff. And he looks physically fit. He's not, you know, you wouldn't look at him and say like, you're not fit. He's muscular. And I'm always like, damn, dude, like you need to like, you know, start taking yoga or do something, you know. But he's like, that's kind of what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Got to take care of the system, man. Got to understand, like, you can't just continue to beat it up and think that it's just going to return if you're not just beating it up. Got to give it that chance to come back. And, you know, like, even walking allows people to recover better, because it's low, low impact. And it's like, you can go forever, but you're just getting the intensity up enough to be really utilizing that aerobic system and training it. And there's no need to open your mouth there either. And so
I like, talked about this really, with you this past summer. I walked hundreds of miles last summer, and it's really cold here right now. So I've got the treadmill out and it's not the same. And I have been taking some walks in the winter, but it fucking sucks when it's like 5 degrees outside. It's just not fun. And I felt great, man. I felt great. Like, I've worked on my feet and worked physically my whole life, but we'd go on like maybe walk like 5-6 miles a day, nothing crazy. Maybe I'd put an earbud in and listen to a book on tape. And you know, when you yawn, it means that you need to take a big breath and get up and do jumping jacks. That's what you got to do in my class when you yawn. Time for jumping jacks.
I'm good. I'm regulated.
I don't want to take up all your time. If somebody's having some of these symptoms that you're talking about, good place to start. How do they find you?
They go to powerspeedendurance.com, go to breathing resources, find the breath calculator. They can do a free CO2 tolerance. They can do the CO2 tolerance test, which they can do it anytime they want. They can learn to do that well. And then they, based on the number they score with that, they can input their time and get breathing protocols set up. They can also use that app.
Yeah. State.
Yep.
Yeah. We can breathe both consciously and unconsciously. Controlling our breath and changing its patterns can help our brain and body. If you ever want me to narrate your app, I can do those voiceovers for you.
Amazing. Amazing. Yeah. So it's sexy.
I like that you are, that you have been, I think that this world is a fucking magical place, that a guy can go from being a street criminal to now hanging out with doctors and high level athletes and people that are incarcerated, helping them change their life, man, using your life's work. That's the American dream right there.
Yeah, it is. It's an amazing time, man. I'm just glad I found what I found when I did what I did and continue to chase that and want to learn from it. I mean, the only sustainable practice is the one you're learning from. So, you know, I'm just learning and we're exploring this pretty deeply.
I dig it. Parting words for our guests.
There's always a better decision to be made. You know, I think understanding the difference between reaction and response is critical. And reacting to something because it upsets you or makes you sad or whatever, I would say your crowd's more leans towards the I get upset phase. I mean, that's what I do. When we get uncomfortable, we start to default to more of our survival skills and how we navigated, you know, the uncomfortable, and that inevitably has us not looking at the reality of what's going on. And so our breath becomes the tool that actually allows us to kind of buy time to look and understand that a little bit deeper. So there's always going to be time, especially in a reactive place. Train it at home, train it in your training, so that when the time does come in a heightened situation, it becomes kind of a default pattern to where I can, okay, instead of reacting to this like this, I'm going to respond in a much better way than I could. Even if the response has to, you know, is similar, it's the ability to look at things like when I get upset with other people and other things, that's the illusion, man. That's the illusion. I'm the one who's involved in that, and I need to look at where my part is in that. And so I've always thought, I believe there's always a better decision to be made, and it can always be refined.
I dig that. That very much coincides with my philosophy of taking responsibility for ourselves and our actions. You can't do shit to me that I don't let you do. You can't make me think a certain way or feel a way. Fuck you, Brian. You made me mad. Like, that don't fly with me.
I know you're incarcerated right now. There's nothing you can do about that. How do you want to do your time?
Yeah.
I can show you something right now that could possibly change your life.
That's deep, and man.
Whether you want to do that in prison or not, it doesn't matter. Like, it's changed my life. It's changed a lot of lives that I've seen. People want me to come and teach this stuff all over the place, and I'm more than happy to.
I think the cool thing is, too, if you've got some specific spiritual belief system, this doesn't contradict that. You know, you can still be whatever it is you want to be. And if you're into things like yoga, this is only going to help you broaden and deepen that practice or sports. But I think sometimes people, I know from my own upbringing, people listen to stuff like this and they think, oh, man, that's fucking weird. It goes against like my spiritual upbringing. It's like, well, that's fucking dumb.
The interesting thing is that the foundation of most yoga practices is breathing.
That's what I'm saying, man. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. Buddhist meditation, same. You know, I mean, it doesn't matter. Breathing's just breathing. You're going to do it anyway. You've got a way of manipulating it that can bring you into deeper layers of yourself, or even calm yourself down, or even bring yourself up, just like coffee.
See, that scares some people. When you say deeper levels of yourself, it's like, oh, that, you know, now maybe I'm elevating myself past some point that I should, or I don't want to, I'm afraid to go in there, man. There's some weird stuff down there. Like, that's what I meant. Some people just get scared of that because it's.
No. I know plenty of people that won't venture there because they're afraid that the world that they actually exist in and the comfort that they've surrounded themselves with may have to change. And that's a true fact. And that probably is the best thing for them. But the problem is we're so tied to the comfort and convenience of it all that we don't want that to change because it requires work and internal work.
Numb.
Yep.
I appreciate you taking the time, man, because you're giving away to the folks listening what others pay for. So hopefully we have some reciprocation to you for your time and energies. Hopefully the universe pays you back. I had to add some of that in, man. I'd like to go jogging with you sometime, but I'll go for like 4 miles. And not 40 or 60, you sicko.
I'm not into ultras anymore, man. I haven't done that in 10 years.
Okay, that's sick. That'd be cool. You guys listening, if you dug this stuff, go check his stuff out. We'll post up some links and stuff like we normally do. Follow him on Instagram. Your Instagram account is?
@_BrianMcKenzie.
@_BrianMcKenzie. I'll put that up here too. If you're checking this out on YouTube or iTunes or Google Play or whatever podcasting platform you're on, leave a review of the conversation. We try very hard. Neither of us are getting paid to have this conversation. Help us out. Share it. Put it on your Facebook page or share it with your friends and family that you think conversations like this can be helpful. No kidding. You may have somebody that's incarcerated in jail and you don't know what you can do to help them. Pass something like this along to them. Send them some of Brian's work and maybe have them come out in a better place.
Or if you're an ER doc, I've got a buddy who's literally saved multiple lives, people bleeding out and having them control their bleeding because they regulated their blood pressure and they saved their life.
Like, that's fantastic. We got to have a cold discussion on that, regulating one's blood pressure.
Yeah.
Another time. You guys that are out there, be good to each other. Don't be dickheads. That's all I got.
All right.
Visit our website, kerrytrainer.com, for information about classes held throughout the U.S., Kerry Trainer apparel, and upcoming projects. You can also email us at training@kerrytrainer.com for information about setting up your own private course or speaking engagement. training@kerrytrainer.com or kerrytrainer.com.